This episode of the pod would not be possible without the support of Sam and the team at Infinite Joinery and Design. If you're like me and normally need to get these guys to come in after you stuff up your latest home renovation, here's an idea. Get them in first and save the hassle. Specialising in new home joinery fit-outs, renovations, kitchens, laundries, wardrobes, vanities and solid timber work and project management, Infinite have 3D design software and Sam alone has over 20 years experience in joinery and project management. Located at 6 Bay Drive, Coiba, come in and have a browse of their colour selection studio, or you can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Or you can contact Sam on 0429 291 008 or email Sam at infinitejoineryanddesign.com. So don't be like me, get the experts in first and save yourself some money and a fierce dressing down from the better half. On this week's show, it was a real pleasure to sit and chat with local legend Tom Butler. When Tom was 20 years old and home from the Australian Defence Force Academy, he was having a fantastic summer with his mates when one bad decision changed his life forever and rendered him a quadriplegic. For someone who's got every right to be mad at the world and negative, Tom's outlook's one of acceptance and making the most out of life, which is a message many people can take on board, not least ones who have only been through probably 10% of what Tom's been through. Tom takes us through his early life and his love of aviation, which led him to the Academy, the fateful day itself and the aftermath, and how he re-engaged back into the community, which for a start wasn't something that was easy for him to do. He was a bit nervous and self-conscious, but now he's a self-confessed social butterfly. It's a great story, and I feel that Tom's story will show you that with the right mindset, you can achieve a happy life regardless of your circumstance. And this is also evident in the fact that Tom's found his way into the sky again, which you'll have to listen to find out how. Hope you enjoy, and please make sure you subscribe, like, leave us a review, recommend the pod to all your mates, and catch up on any episodes that you've missed out on. We really appreciate it.
G'day everybody, welcome back to the Talk Hard Podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Briley.
I'm Sonny.
We hope you enjoy today's episode.
I get a phone call basically saying, Dad's not it.
This sit-down lawnmower is like about 3 metres long. By the time I was finished with it, it was about half a metre.
A fully grown man sleeping with the light on. Shit, scared.
He's come out my car with an angle grinder before.
It's just such an important thing for so many people.
And I thought, holy shit, I'm going to get delisted next tomorrow. Like, that's kind of put a line through me.
So that's why checking in on your mate or your son or your daughter or your player or your coach or whoever it is, you become the psych.
I just let him know that, you know, it's tough, but we're tougher.
And he just wrapped those big arms that he's got around me and just said, mate, like, we'll work through this together. Like, oh, I absolutely love you.
The Talk Hard Podcast with Brendan Hinks.
Tom Butler, welcome to the Talk Hard Podcast.
Thanks very much, Brendan. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure, mate. I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone because this is the first time that I've ventured outside of my comfy little studio. So
good setup at the kitchen bench.
It does the job. That's the main thing. We can work remotely. I know that now. I can tick that one off. Yep. So it's fantastic to be here in your home for a start, mate. I am a little bit disappointed. I thought it would see more Geelong stuff. Where's all that?
There's a bit of stuff around.
Is there?
Yeah.
You're not putting it in people's faces?
There's the coaster there under my drinking jug.
Oh, there we go.
And there's a badge over there that's waiting to get stuck on something. So
awesome.
Yeah.
No, I knew you were a big Cats man, mate, as am I. Most people that come into the Talk Hard studio, you know, cringe when they come in because we have all the posters and things.
My 2023 member scarf turned up today. I was disappointed it didn't have my sticker from my car, though. So
oh, right,
I just sent them an email wondering where that is.
Follow them up on that one.
Yeah.
Keep someone in a job anyway. First question that I've got for you, though, which premiership was the best one out of the four to pick from in our time, mate?
The first one, I reckon, 2007. Yep. After such a long, my dad's been a Geelong supporter for a long time and had been waiting for a very long time for premiership, so yeah, it was good to watch it with him and see the victory.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I'm the same. If that was the one that I had to, if I had to pick one, that'd probably be the one that I'd go for as well, because it was, you know, it was new and we'd waited for so long, and yep. I was probably three parts pissed too, which always helps.
Yeah.
The last one I wasn't, you know, I'm an old man now, so it was more getting the enjoyment out of me boy actually watching his team win one. So hopefully they can win another one this year. We'll see how we go.
Yeah.
We can all retire happy now, though. We've seen enough of them, haven't we?
Yeah, we've had a pretty good run for, like, you look at Selwood's winning stats for his captain or whatever, and it's been an insanely good period of time for Cat supporters.
Unbelievable. You can see why everyone else hates him, but we love him.
Yep.
So, as I say, we're in your beautiful home, mate, and I know it's a real source of pride for you. So, just before we get into your story, which we will, just tell us a little bit about how this place came about and the SDA and how that sort of worked in your life, because I know it's a real passion for you.
Yep. So, I was living with my dad and his wife in a specially built unit next to their house in Devonport, and sort of dad was approaching retirement and I didn't want to sort of be there with him caring for me sort of too long into his retirement years, so we sort of came to an agreement that we'd try and find somewhere else for me to live sort of as the years going on and he was approaching retirement. So that was sort of early 2010s. And I went on the housing needs register for the state government and pretty much heard nothing about that over the next sort of 6 years or so. So a small block of land came up for sale in Devonport near the showgrounds that I could afford, and I wasn't sure if I'd ever be able to live there or not, but I saw it as the best opportunity to take. So I didn't want to live in a nursing home or a group home or anything like that.
So that was offered to you though, didn't you?
Well, not so much, but they were pretty much the only other offers.
Yep.
There was one that came up at the back of TAFE, which was a new sort of development for people with disability, but it was only, there were only like one bedroom units, and I've got a lot of crap and would never be able to fit into something like that. So,
yep.
And I value my privacy and stuff like that, so I didn't want to live sort of just right close to six or seven other people.
Yeah.
So I knew it would be a bit more dangerous, a bit less safe living by myself, but I really wanted to give it a try if I could.
Good on you.
And I knew the NDIS was on the horizon for my age group, because like Tassie's rollout for the NDIS was age group based, and so my age group rolled into the system in the middle of 2018, so I was one of the first. I didn't have to wait. I was in the first sort of group of people when my age group became eligible, so that was my sort of time frame for wanting to time the build to be able to move in around then, but it ended up blowing out as all building projects do. So once I was in the NDIS, I was able to increase my support hours to be able to sort of become more independent from my dad and also my mum. Like, my mum lives locally, and she spends a lot of time with me too. Mum and dad, they still help me out a lot, but they're a lot less than what they used to.
Yeah.
Thanks to the NDIS. I started planning the build after I bought the property, but my dad was friends with Steve Daly, who was a local well-known person.
Yep.
Passed away, unfortunately, last year or the year before.
Yep.
But at the time when he knew I was looking at housing stuff, he told me to look at something called specialist disability accommodation. And I looked it up and it was all seemed really complicated and I didn't understand it. So I didn't think it would be something that I really needed to look at too much. But probably about 3 months after that, in early 2017, I came across an article for a newsletter from an organisation called Every Australian Counts, which was sort of NDIS focused, and it was about the new rules for specialist disability accommodation being released, and it just had one line in it that jumped out at me, which was saying that it even allows for a participant to be their own provider of housing. So I sort of asked a few more questions, and they said this is an interesting aspect of the NDIS, and so I did lots of reading on it, and it sort of 1 o'clock in the morning one morning it sort of dawned on me that the figures in there for the funding levels were actually annual figures, not just one-off, and they were paid over 20 years. So
yep.
It's like, wow, this is actually like $20,000 plus towards a house sort of per year. So
it's funny these revelations that come at 1 a.m.
Yeah. So I didn't sleep the rest of that night because I was so excited about what it could mean. Like, because I wasn't sure. I could afford half a house, but I couldn't afford a full house, and I didn't have a high enough income to take a traditional sort of mortgage out to, or construction loan to build a house. So I still had a few hurdles to get through because the SDA money doesn't start until after the house is built. So,
yep.
But it meant I had to modify my plans because there's really strict requirements that SDA houses have to be built to. There's no wiggle room. Like, the hallway has to be a certain width, and if they come in and assess it and they say, no, that's 10 millimetres too narrow, like, you have to literally redo the whole hallway, to otherwise you won't qualify for the funding. So sort of designing the house, had to be very careful. I had to know the standards inside and out.
Yep.
And find a builder that was happy to build to the high standards. And it was my neighbour's nephew, Shane Taylor, was really good to work with. And and he sort of let me manage post lockup a lot of the build, so we were able to bring in friends and family to help keep costs down and do some of the stuff ourselves. So it was really good. I'd always wanted to build my own home. I never thought it would be possible. So and having an uncertain housing future is the best motivator that I've ever had. I struggle for energy a lot of the time, but
yep.
that was a great thing to focus on.
Yep.
And yeah, so the build did drag out a bit. It wasn't until the end of 2019, but that gave me time to get assessed for the SDA funding. And I was assessed at the level that I was hoping to be, which is like a fairly high level of funding. Because there was a lot of uncertainty back then about who qualified for what, and there was really hard to find any information. So
yeah.
I didn't mean to be a trailblazer with it, but it turned out I was probably the first person in Australia to build their own home through SDA. So
well done.
I've sort of take a lot of phone calls and emails these days now for people that want to do the same sort of thing, and I've got a Facebook page with like 1500 members of people that want to do the same thing. So
yeah,
there's a few people out there that have done it, and lots that are still wanting to do it. So
yeah,
it's been really rewarding, and I've got a couple of jobs out of it too. So it's been a really major part of my life for the last sort of 5 years. So
yeah,
6 years. Yeah, it's been really good. And yeah, moved into my place at the end of 2019. So yeah, it was very daunting, but it's been awesome. I love having my own place and having the security and yeah, it's just been really great.
Excellent. And isn't it funny though, like it doesn't matter how long it takes you to find your passion, when you do find something that sort of fuels your fire, obviously you're getting a big buzz out of that now and helping other people as well. So are you actually aligned with the scheme itself, or are you just an advisor that just advises random people that are looking into it? Or
I'm the world's cheapest NDIS consultant free.
It doesn't get any cheaper than that.
I'm happy to donate my time to anyone that wants to try and go down the same sort of path. So
yep.
Yeah, and so I'm a member of the SDA Alliance, which is the peak body for SDA in Australia. So
yep.
I sort of get a few people to talk through that. I've got a part-time job with them, just contracting to sort of handle their social media accounts and
yep.
Manage an online forum for them. And I also got a job through, it's called the Summer Foundation. They're a charity in Melbourne that work to keep young people out of nursing homes. So SDA is a real major factor for them to try and get people out of nursing homes and stop them from going into nursing homes. So
yep.
They employed me just part-time as a lived experience workshop facilitator. So
yep.
I help run webinars and online workshops and stuff to teach people about their housing options through the NDIS, specifically SDA.
Yep.
And also, like, I did a guide up for people that specifically wanted to be self-providers of SDA. So
yep.
Yeah, it's been popular and it's got lots of good feedback. So it's been, yeah, really good thing to do.
Excellent. And you're getting a big kick out of it as well?
Yeah, I still struggle big time with energy levels. Like it can be a challenge sometimes to do the work, but it's really rewarding when I do it, and I'm glad that I've got that to do.
Excellent. So obviously we will get into your story, and a lot of people, or some people that are listening to this, obviously will know you and will know a little bit about your story. But just before we go into your story and your accident and things like that, can you just tell people what the result of your accident was and what your actual injury was that led to your current situation?
Yep. So I'm a C4-5 complete quadriplegic. So that means that I severed my spinal cord at the fourth and fifth vertebra from the top of the spine. So complete means that the spinal cord was completely severed. So that means I've got no sensation or movement below about halfway down my shoulders, down my chest. So some people would have what's called an incomplete injury, where the spinal cord is only partially damaged, and you might be technically quadriplegic but still be able to walk.
Okay.
But you might just have impaired sensation on some of your skin somewhere. Or
yep.
You see a lot of people that are like Dylan Alcott. I think he's technically a quadriplegic, even though most people would probably think he's a paraplegic because he
moves his arms pretty well.
Yeah, and he swings a tennis racket pretty well. So he must just have maybe a slight impairment in some of his fingers or something like that. But so for me, it was a lot higher than that. But I still, like, there's always someone worse off. If I was any, like, a vertebra higher or something, I wouldn't have been able to breathe by myself. So I'm very lucky that I've got a little bit of movement in my left arm, which is enough just to drive my wheelchair. I don't have any movement in my fingers or anything, but I wear a hand splint to keep my wrist straight.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I can drive my chair because I'm very thankful for that. Otherwise, I'd be in a chin control. But when I first had my accident, they assumed I'd be in a chin control because I didn't have any movement in either arm. It was the movement came back slowly in my left arm that was able to allow me to do that. So
yep.
Yeah, it's, you've got to be thankful for small mercies. So
absolutely. That was one of the main reasons I wanted to have a chat to you, because, you know, even just following you on socials and things like that, I knew you had a, you know, a great attitude and outlook towards life. And I know that sometimes it's people that have, that probably could sit around and feel sorry for themselves and have been through the lowest lows, sometimes have the best attitude. So I reckon there'll be a lot of learnings that people are going to take from it. How scary is it in this day and age how much we rely on modern technology? It's not till your phone dies or the Wi-Fi or power goes off that you realise you'd be lost without it. Well, recently my phone decided in its old age to die and stop charging, and on a weekend no less. So what do? Rather than waiting to speak to the network providers or retail outlets, which can be painful within itself, give Brad or Katie a call at Greenies Apple Repairs. That's what I did, and they had my old phone as good as new in hours. Greenies take care of iPhones, iPods, iPads, and pretty much everything else, and they won't cost you an arm and a leg. So next time you're stuck back in the dark ages with no technology, contact Greenies Apple Repairs on 0401 229 220, or you can contact them at www.greeniesrepairs.com.au or find them on Facebook. Now just to get onto this busted screen. Just take us back to the start. So you're a Sydney boy. I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
You're a ring-in.
Sydney, yep, South Sydney.
Yep.
Grew up there until I was 11.
Yep.
Used to live in a town called Picton outside of Sydney. It's probably part of Sydney now. It's grown so much since then. That was a great spot. I really loved it there. I always tell people I was dragged kicking and screaming to Tassie.
Yep.
Sounds
like my wife. She's a Queenslander.
Really?
Yeah.
When we moved into Port Sorell and the whole area, like I came here and it's only two TV channels and one cinema that got the movies about 3 months late. And
yep.
No Maccas, which was a big deal at the time. I couldn't care less now, really. But yeah, it's certainly come a long way since then, and it does grow in your Tassie. I love it here now. So yeah, I'm very happy being here.
Awesome. And what sort of kid were you? Were you pretty active, pretty sporty? Or?
Well, I certainly love my computer games.
Yep.
But yeah, still lots of bike riding and out all hours of the day. And I used to love roller skating, so I used to sort of go roller skating three times a week. There was an awesome rink nearby in Campbelltown, and that was another bit of a downgrade coming to Devonport, the old Roller City.
Mm.
I used to go there heaps of, even though it was a bit of a downgrade, but yeah, I still love my roller skating. So I did half of or two-thirds of grade six in Wesley Vale, and we moved down first up, so made a lot of good friends. There, shout out to one of my best mates, Tom Hall. He asked me to play with him and his friends on the first day of school, so yep. Never forgot that. Wesley Vale was great, and then went on to Latrobe and had a really good time there. Made lots of good friends and had a great time.
Excellent. And you always had a had an interest in flying and aviation and that sort of stuff, so that led to your next step, didn't it? So where did you go to from schooling?
Yeah, so I was lucky that I always knew what I wanted to do, which was to be a pilot in the Air Force. So, like, that made it so much easier with school, like picking subjects and stuff like that. I knew what I had to, like, focus on maths and science, and that's where my interest was anyway.
Yep.
And school was always pretty easy for me. Maybe that wasn't a great thing all the time because I didn't try as hard as what I would need to. I call myself the world's greatest procrastinator, and I was a bit well known in school for leaving things to the last minute and still getting pretty good marks for it. So
yep.
It got harder to do that when I went to uni. I'm sure it wouldn't have served me well if I had got further through uni before my accident.
Yep.
Don College, I did sort of all the maths and science and pre-tertiary subjects. Like, I knew I needed to get, because I wanted to go to the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra, which is pretty competitive to get into, and I was always wondering whether I would be able to be good enough to get in there or not. So
yep.
I knew I had to do as well as I could at school. So
yep.
Well, within my procrastination. The next thing,
you just did enough. That's the main thing.
Yeah. So yeah. I did extra things, like in grade 12. Yeah, I think you only had to do four pre-tertiaries and you could have the fifth line off, but I did a fifth pre-tertiary because I wanted to do like an easy subject for me, which was maths applied. Like I knew I'd get 20 points for that, which would boost my score.
So yeah, so she was strategic about it.
Yeah, yeah, I sort of wanted to do as well at school as I could. So
nice.
And yeah, I was successful, so I was accepted to the Defence Force Academy.
So what's just to stop you, what's the selection process? What did you actually have to do?
So it was actually, it's something I'm bitter about 25 years later.
So you don't hold on to things.
No, not at all. In year 11, they hand out these things called the Sir Richard Williams Scholarship to the Air Force, to the Academy, and they only hand out like 80 a year. So I applied for that as a pilot. So I went down to Hobart and you do a whole battery of tests. And then you go to Melbourne and I think Melbourne might have been for the actual application process. It was just Hobart for the scholarship application. And so I did all that, and you have interviews with psychologists and recruiters and stuff like that. And so, because I applied as pilot, they put you through the pilot tests, and there was like 1 5-minute test out of an hour worth of tests that I looked at the wrong diagram for the wrong set of answers or whatever, so I failed it. And you can't fail any of the tests, otherwise you fail overall. So I failed as pilot for that scholarship application, but I sort of reapplied as navigator, and I was successful. I got one of the scholarships as navigator.
Yeah.
But then when I came at the end of year 12 to reapply for ADFA, they said, sorry, you've got to have at least 12 months before you can retake this test, and hasn't been enough time gone by, so I couldn't reapply as pilot for that one.
Yep.
But I was happy to reapply as navigator, and I was successful getting into ADFA for navigator.
Yep.
I would have been happy to be paid to be up in the air anyway as a nav, but I would have reapplied while I was at ADFA as pilot because they allow that, so because that was still what I really wanted to do. So I was very, very proud to get into ADFA.
Yep.
And that was, so I went to that in January of 99 after finishing Don College in 98.
Yep. So tell me, what is it that you love about flying? Because I know it's still a passion of yours. What sort of draws you to the sky?
My dad was an air traffic controller when I was growing up, so I always remember going to work with him, sitting up in the tower watching the planes come and go. And my uncle was in the Air Force as a technician, like an avionics technician. So I grew up around a lot of aircraft, and I just caught the bug early on. Like, I think people that love aviation sort of have loved it for a long time. It really gets into your skin and sort of becomes something that you just want to do. And I was able to do flying lessons when I was sort of around 16, 17. That just sort of made me even more passionate for wanting to do it. So I got to fly solo a couple of times after only 8 hours of instruction. That was pretty daunting. I find it funny now that you're not allowed to drive by yourself without like 50 or 100 hours or whatever it is these days.
Yep.
I was able to fly a plane by myself after 8 hours.
Yep. You'll be right, mate. Off you go.
Yeah.
And how did you go?
Flying's easy. It's the bloody radio communications and stuff like that I struggled with. And
I thought you were going to say flying's easy. It's landing that's tricky.
Well, That's true as well. That's the trickiest bit.
Yeah. And how did you go, though, when you got up there?
I was good, except I did miss a radio call from someone else on, because there's no controller at Devonport Airport. You've got to just call out your own movements and communicate with other people. So, there was a guy that was waiting to take off, and he had to coax me to reply to him because he could see me in the sky on my circuit.
Yep.
So, that was the only problem. But everything else went well. The flying part was fine.
And was that the only time that you got to fly solo on your own?
I did another one once after that, just another one of circuits around Devonport Airport. So it was always, I was picking freesias at the time, so it was took a lot of flower picking to pay for the flights. My girlfriend's family at the time, the Ahearns, they bought me my first voucher for flying instruction, I think. So that was an awesome thing. I paid for the ones that I could after that. So my scholarship was $1,000, the Sir Richard Williams scholarship, so that paid for a few flights as well. So really good.
Excellent. And now that you look back, obviously, you know how things have panned out, do you sort of look back on that, you know, with fondness now that you did get the opportunity to fly? Is that like a really big feather in your cap now?
Very happy that I got to do it. I just wish I had been able to do a bit more of it.
Yep. But there is a certain way that you have been flying, which we're going to talk about later on as well, because I know it is still a bit of a passion of yours. But so you were in the Defence Force for 12 months, was that right, before you came back for Christmas?
Yeah, so I started in January and came back in December for Christmas holidays.
Yep.
After finishing the first year of aeronautical engineering. So I was in a division of, we were all first year male engineering cadets. So that was probably one of my best years of my life at the Defence Force Academy. We got to do lots of adventure training stuff and ground defence training and all this sort of stuff, so that was really good. But yeah, it was great to come back at Christmas time to catch up with mates and do lots of fun things.
Yep, excellent. And obviously when you were back was when you had your accident, which was, you know, life-changing for you. Can you take people through that day and what you remember about it?
Yeah, so it was actually the day before I was supposed to go back to Canberra for the academy. I was going to have having one last swim with my mates. We always went to the jetty out at Port Sorell, the old jetty, which has been torn down since.
Yeah, a lot of people would know the area.
Possibly because of me is one of the reasons it was torn down.
That's your legacy.
Well, actually, two other people were hurt themselves on the same day. So
oh, right.
Not as bad as me, but yeah, so it was actually low tide that day, and I hadn't swam there at low tide for quite a while, not that summer that I'd been back, and so it had been probably a year since I'd swam there at low tide. And I remember I used to be able to do a pin drop off the side of it at low tide and still not hit the bottom, but it was my first jump for the day, and like I was always scared of diving, but I can quite clearly remember thinking, well, the only way you get over your fears is to do these things. And I was a terrible diver, which is probably what counted against me again, because I sort of had this idea that a dive was a reverse pin drop and sort of dive straight down instead of diving out.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sure if I saw a replay of what I did, I would think, you bloody idiot.
You can swear, mate, if you want. You wouldn't be the first.
Yeah. I don't know what I was thinking. It was just an absolute moment of stupidity. I didn't think and took this very deep dive into what turned out to be very shallow water and smashed my head on the bottom, and I came back up. Well, instantly I couldn't move. So I was face down in the water, and obviously knew I was in trouble straight away. So all I could do was shake my head. And I was actually swimming with my friend Tom Hall and Troy Nichols. So Troy was the first one that came over and turned me over. So thankfully I didn't drown. Thanks, Troy. I did actually swallow some seawater, which led to a lung infection later on when I was in hospital, chest infection. So there were quite a few people swimming around, and everyone sort of was pretty shocked by it, I'm sure. They kept me in the water and stabilised my spine and called the ambulance. And I just remember thinking, man, I'm stuffed. Like, I pretty much knew what I'd done straight away.
Was there any pain, can I ask?
No, it wasn't really pain. It was starting to get a bit difficult to breathe, which was a bit scary. But I was fairly calm. Just waiting for the ambulance to come and take me to the Mersey Hospital, which I was really lucky. There was a guy there, I think it was Dr. Yastrebov.
Mm-hmm.
He was like quite qualified in my sort of injury and stabilised me, and I was very lucky that I didn't need a tracheotomy, which is like to breathe through your neck if your breathing's compromised. So
yeah,
because that can do some long-term damage to your windpipe and stuff. So I pretty much remember getting wheeled out of the ambulance into the hospital, and then I wake up in Melbourne sometime later.
So. Yeah. So obviously with your accident, you had like this is going to be my ignorance and this is going to sound really stupid, but you had like some sort of concussion or did it knock it out at all?
Didn't seem to. Like, I was worried I might have had a brain injury from it, but
yep.
No one's ever told me.
Yep.
I have.
Yep.
Nothing's shown up.
So yep.
Yeah, somehow I didn't. But, and it was just, it's a spinal cord injury like that is just a complete lottery. It could have been a few vertebrae higher and I would be dead instantly, or it could be a few vertebrae lower and I'd be able to be in a manual chair and probably look after myself and need hardly any carers. So it's just an absolute lottery ticket, really.
Yep. And so you said that you were sort of floating face down for a while until somebody came to you. Do you remember what was going through your mind at that time, or what your feelings were?
It was just panic at that time, because it was just like I can't breathe and I can't turn myself over, so I hope someone helps.
Yeah.
And like there were plenty of people around, so like it was like great that Troy was nearby to turn me over so quickly.
Yeah.
I think I probably still did swallow some seawater, which is or inhale some seawater, which is probably near where I got the infection from.
Yeah. And so how old were you, sorry, at the time, you and your friends?
So I turned 18 in October and had an accident on the 17th of January. So I got to see you in the year 2000, which was a good New Year's Eve celebration at downtown in Devonport.
Yeah.
Had a great night. Yeah, and I had an awesome summer with my friends. So it was a very sad end to what was a great time.
And just talking to your friends, obviously, were any of them trained in first aid? Like, for them to know to keep you in the water and to keep you stable? And because, you know, the natural reaction would be to just drag you out onto the sand. But if anyone that's done first aid knows that you've got to try and stabilise the neck. Did they know anything about that, or did they just naturally just click into gear?
I don't think my friends would have known anything, but there were so many people around. There would have been people that had first aid training.
Oh, okay, yep.
But, like, I still run into people occasionally that say they remember my accident, or they were out there or something like that. So yeah, there were quite a few people around, so
yep.
Hopefully, well, it looks like some of them had knowledge of what to do.
This episode of the pod's proudly brought to you by J Beck Mechanical Repairs. With the ever-rising cost of living, we're all looking for ways to save a few bucks so you can spend it in the areas that you love. One area JBEC can help you is with the rising cost of fuel prices. Why not remap your vehicle to gain more power and better fuel economy through their chip tuning service? Chip tuning can be done on many vehicles, including various trucks and tractors, and conditions apply. With over 30 years combined experience in small engine cars and diesel engines, Jade and his team are qualified in both diesel and petrol vehicles. They offer a mobile field service unit, including breakdown services, all mechanical repairs, engine rebuilds, as well as aircon and auto electrical services. To find out more, just find JBEC Mechanical Repairs on Facebook, email jbecinvestments@gmail.com, or call or text 0492 594 058. Tell them Brendan sent you for a free cuddle, and trust me, that's better than a handshake, because Jade's fingers will crush you. JBEC Mechanical Repairs, offering chip tuning. Unleash the power within.
And so at what point through, you know, your accident, going to hospital and then waking up in Melbourne, at what point do you start to think, or does it start to enter your mind that, you know, I might have lost mobility because of this accident? Can you remember when that sort of started to kick in?
Pretty much straight away. I certainly didn't have any experience with spinal cord injury before my accident, but yep. I knew what it was to break your neck, like, and I didn't know anything about complete and incomplete injuries or anything. I just assumed that, like, I was pretty much going to be like that for the rest of my life. So it's like people tell stories and they recount when the doctor says, oh, you're probably not going to walk again, and they find that as a sort of traumatic experience. I think I can remember smiling when the doctor sort of gave me that talk, because I was like, of course I'm not going to walk again. Like, that's just the reality, isn't it? So I was always pretty accepting of what I'd done. And like looking back on it, I sort of like it's a terrible thing that happened, but I don't have the anger about it that maybe some other people might have, because it was my own stupid fault. Like, I can't blame anything. It's not like a drunk driver collected me and put me in the chair and stuff like that, so I don't have to sort of question why did this happen. And like some people say, oh, everything happens for a reason. And I saw a good meme from a few years ago that, and it was, everything happens for a reason, and that reason is physics.
Yep.
Which is pretty funny. And I do joke that I know why my accident happened, because I found out when we were going through my wallet a few weeks later in hospital that my driver's license had run out. So it was lucky I broke my neck so I didn't get a fine for driving with an expired license.
The universe was looking after you, yep, in one way.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. So you said that you were pretty accepting of it straight away. Did you have any dark moments, though, like through those early times, like where it did sort of hit home and it really, you know, sort of affected you emotionally at all? Or?
Yeah, it definitely did. Like, especially early on, you get what's called neurogenic pain sometimes when you have parts of your body that's paralyzed. So for the first month or so, even though I couldn't feel my legs, it felt like my legs were absolutely icicles, and it felt like I'd broken my back and I was being sort of pulled down through the mattress in the middle of the bed, and that was agony. Like, I really didn't sleep for weeks and weeks. It didn't feel like I probably slept during the day, and they gave you some pretty powerful drugs to try and to minimise that. But luckily that only lasted a month or so, where some people have to deal with that their whole life.
Okay.
So, yeah, and obviously absolutely devastating to know that everything, like my dreams, were up in smoke. And but I sometimes say that being in Melbourne in rehab, that was like 7 months I was in Melbourne. That was kind of the easy time. Like, it's when you come home that everything really hits how permanent everything is, and that you're going to be a burden, even though people, especially my friends and family, say don't feel like you're a burden. But like, as an individual, like, you can't help feeling like that, I think. So yeah, it was certainly harder when I got home.
Yeah, and I'll talk to you about that in a second, but it's interesting that you bring up your friends and family. So what were their initial reactions and support through those early times? How were they?
Yeah, well, they were amazing. I'm very lucky to have a great family. Mum and dad, pretty much, like, they had been divorced before then, but they took turns coming over to Melbourne. They spent a huge amount of time over there with me, and like, cooked for me and stuff, so I didn't have to have hospital food all the time.
Yep.
Which is maybe a bad thing, because I put on weight pretty rapidly.
She was good home cooking then.
Yeah. Or when take out and stuff like that, so I love my food. I wish someone had told me that once you put weight on as a quadriplegic, it's nearly impossible to lose it again. So I ended up getting type 2 diabetes a few years ago, which allowed me to lose the weight, but it's not the best way to lose weight.
If you're listening, kids.
So just to be able to have mum and dad over there, and my friends from the Defence Force Academy, they actually, my Air Force friends, they were coming to Melbourne shortly after the uni year had restarted for like Air Force specific training. So I had a couple of weeks there where I was getting lots of visits from them, and friends from Devonport and Tassie, a fair few came over to visit me and stuff in hospital. So
yeah,
it was really good to be able to get all that support, and a huge amount of fundraising was done for me, both in Canberra and back here in Tassie, and that meant just so much to know that was all being done for me.
Yeah, just on your friends, like, there's an old saying that, you know, you find out who your friends are at your toughest moments. Do you subscribe to that? Did you learn a bit about people through that time?
Yeah, definitely. Just the support that everyone had for me was so good to have. I had a whole heap of photos up on the wall of that everyone had sort of sent to me with various friends and stuff like that, and so that was really good support to have around me, and lots of phone calls and stuff like that. It was a bit kind of the days before email and stuff like that, so it was mostly phone calls.
Yep. And just in those times when you're over in Melbourne, how would you describe your mindset? What was your main feeling? Was it like hope, or was it acceptance, or was it motivation? Can you remember what your self-talk was like, what you were saying to yourself?
Mostly acceptance, I guess. Like, I've always been kind of a go with the flow kind of person, and that's how I approached the accident too. I have struggled with depression ever, like, since the accident, so I can't say I was always positive and it was easy, but I've always been fairly accepting of it and just trying to make the best of what I can.
Yeah. And you said, so after that you came back to Tassie, so that was pretty important for you to come back to Tasmania?
Yeah, well, I kind of saw it as pretty much the only choice. Like, I suppose, like, I was too young, and I would have had a lot more opportunities if I was living in a city like Melbourne if I had stayed over there, but I definitely wanted to come back to where I was, sort of where home was still. They started to build a unit at the back of my dad's place in Devonport, and so that was sort of, dad paid for part of that, and fundraising paid for the rest of it, so we're really lucky to have people volunteer time, and friends helped with that too, and a lot of stuff was donated, so it was great to finally be able to come back to live in Devonport with dad and mum in support. And back then, like, this is a long time before the NDIS, like, the most you could get care wise was like 34 hours a week through the government care. So when I'd been in rehab, I was there with people that had car accidents and stuff like that. So it sort of, it was a bit of a divide between the haves and have-nots, because if you had a, there was a person there that was a lower level injury than me, but had a car accident and got 24-hour day care, and I came back to Tassie and I was sort of, the most I was allowed to do was like less than 5 hours a day, so it really didn't allow for anything other than the personal care. So I was grateful that I could rely on carers for personal care, and not have to get my family to do that, but it meant that there wasn't really any time left over for what we call community access these days, and like these days I'm out as much as I can.
Yep.
But back then I was a bit of a hermit, so
yeah. And I remember you said to me though that you look back on that time now and you regret that you didn't get out and about, because you did sort of struggle, didn't you, initially with those
first times. Yeah, I was very self-conscious, wasn't comfortable in my own skin back then, and sort of didn't really want to be seen out by people I knew, and we lived right in the middle of Devonport near the Kmart, and if I lived there now, I'd be out every day for coffees and meals and stuff like that. So, we moved out of town a few years after, I really regretted every trip being a car trip into town then. So I really wish I had been a bit more out and about back then, and I probably would have maintained a few more friendships. It was sort of very easy being that way to let friendships sort of slide. I'm not the best communicator out there, a bit slack when it comes to emails and phone calls and stuff like that, so it's certainly one of my regrets of that time.
Yeah. And you say before though you were self-conscious about people you knew seeing you. Can you explain why that was? Like what were your thoughts? Because sometimes we say that, you know, what we think other people think about us is sometimes it's not actually going to be the case, but it's strong enough to hold you back. Like, what did you think that people would think of you if they saw you?
Yeah, I don't even know if I can put it into words. I just felt really self-conscious and embarrassed, maybe, or I don't know. I just didn't want to be sort of seen as disabled as I was. I just really wasn't comfortable with it at that stage, so... I feel really bad about it now because I'm so far opposite for that. Like, I don't care at all. Like, I just want to go out as often as I can. That's sort of my mental health thing, is to go out for coffees with friends and family and even carers when I can. So, yeah, I wish I could go back to that self and slap him in the face and tell him to get out there and get over it a bit more.
Yeah, you've come full circle now then.
Mm.
Absolutely. And around that time, you also got involved back in the Touch Footy Association, is that right? You reconnected with them, and that was a pretty big, important step for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'd always played touch footy in high school, and had played for Tassie for under-16s and under-18s. So that was my only sport, really, growing up. And I'd done some refereeing and stuff for the association, the Devonport Touch Association, and they were... like, they were supportive after my accident. They had donated some money to my trust. And when I came home, they offered me a traineeship as just doing the behind-the-scenes stuff for the competition. So I really appreciated that. It was something for me to focus on sort of pretty quickly after I came home. So I did that for probably 2.5 years before I went back to uni to... try and study uni by distance, but I stayed on the committee for Touch Footy, so I ended up doing that for like nearly 20 years, and I was made a life member and got to keep in touch with a lot of people that I already knew or made new friends through Touch Footy, so it was really a positive experience.
Yep. And was that important for your recovery mentally, like going from, as you say, like a self-confessed hermit to being in an environment with a lot of people? Did that sort of build your self-confidence and help with your mental health, being around people again?
Yeah, probably a little bit. Like, I didn't actually need to be at Touch Footy for most of the work, so I still was able to be a bit of a hermit and do the job.
You could pick and choose.
Yeah, we had committee meetings at my place, which was good to be included in that way. I'd get down occasionally for games and stuff like that. Like, as the years went on, I got down a lot more, especially when we moved. It was near Coles Beach, so I could actually drive myself in my wheelchair along to the Touch Footy grounds at Muircroft. So I could go there just whenever I needed to, when it was, the weather was good.
Yep.
Yeah, it was really good.
In the world today, mental health is an issue which thankfully more and more people are becoming aware of and comfortable speaking about. When choosing a professional to help you, what kind of service would you be looking for? At Lonvara, when asked to describe Mel Purcell's service, clients described it as real, compassionate, empowering, friendly, welcoming, inner strength building, a positive, safe, supportive environment, and she was described by one source as an absolute legend who enables change with love. Mel offers clinical counselling, hypnotherapy, and a professional service which is tailored to the individual. She has a personal approach and makes sure each client's experience is authentic to their needs while also ensuring full confidentiality. Winner of the 2022 Australian Allied Health Awards for Rural and Remote Excellence, you can self-refer or through your GP mental health care plan. Lonvara, believing in you. And you touched on there before that you got back into uni, but you did have to withdraw from that because that was when your mental health really started to hit its lowest point, didn't it?
Yeah, so I was... The problem when all you want to do is be a pilot in the Air Force and that gets taken away from you and you don't have any other passions, it's sort of really hard to know what else to do. So study-wise, I chose poorly by choosing information systems, a sort of an IT-based degree to try and do. So I did that for 3 years, just part-time. And yeah, I just really struggled. I couldn't really see how it would lead to a job for me, especially in Devonport. And so, yeah, I deferred that and then never went back. I wish in hindsight I had done something like financial planning or accounting, because I had found out later that I had a lot of interest in that.
So how old were you at the time?
Early 20s.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting though, like sometimes it takes till your 30s, even 40s to find out what your true passions are.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so now, I don't know, I feel like I'm unteachable for new things. I would really struggle to go back to uni now. I sort of don't rule it out maybe further down the track, but yeah, at the moment I'm happy with the SDA focus and got more land and I'm planning on building again, so that's sort of taking up a lot of my thinking at the moment, so that'll do me for the next couple of years, I reckon.
Yeah. And you said when I was talking to you there before that your mental health did hit probably its lowest point there. Like how low did you get? Like how bad was a really bad day? Can you sort of put it into words?
Yeah, it was really, really bad. I can just remember sort of feeling like a zombie and like everything is pointless, everything's too hard, like not being able to do anything for myself and being so reliant on everyone for everything. Like I'm sure people could have half an imagine of what that would be like. It's not a nice feeling. And yeah, thinking a lot of the time that it would be better off if I wasn't here. Yeah, I was definitely very down and I wouldn't say I was suicidal. Like I thought about suicide a lot, but it was actually depressing to think about it because I think, well, there's not that many ways I could actually do it even if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of made it even worse in a sense. But I tried sort of counselling with psychologists and I didn't have much luck with that. I don't know, because I felt like it's my situation that caused the depression, and there's nothing we can really do to change the situation. So I didn't have much success sort of trying to deal with that through counselling and stuff like that. So I always had avoided antidepressants because I felt like that was sort of the easy way out and not solving things, but I did end up trying them and I had to try a few different ones before I found one that worked, but when they worked amazingly well. So
yeah,
it just meant that I just stopped dwelling on the things that made me sad and could focus on the positives and find a lot more enjoyment in life. And so yeah, I still think it still does seem like the easy way out, and I have tried to come off them before and that didn't work well at all. But talking to my doctor recently, I probably will try again because I'm in a pretty good place at the moment and I would like to see if I can come off them if I can.
Yep. So just last one on your mental health. Do you think that was something that was probably always there? This is the situational depression argument as opposed to the hereditary type depression that was always going to happen. Do you feel like you may have had like little parts of mental health before, or do you think it was because of your accident or maybe because of uni that brought it on?
No, definitely my accident. I didn't have any hint of it before, so
yep.
I don't ever remember feeling like depression as like we understand depression these days, so it was 100% just my situation for me.
Yeah. And what would your advice be to somebody who is going through that sort of situation at the moment and they are feeling low? Like, what sort of advice would you give to someone if they came and asked you about mental health?
Yeah, well, definitely talk to people about it, whether it's friends or professionals and doctors. There's so many ways that you can be helped these days. And like, mindfulness is not for me, but I can't deny that there's a lot of science behind mindfulness and it works for a lot of people. So,
yep.
If it's antidepressants as well, then give them a go too, because they can work very well.
Yeah, excellent. That's the heavy stuff, mate. Let's get on to a few of your passions now. So we've spoken about flying a number of times. So you're also able to reconnect with the sky in a certain way, weren't you? Tell us about your passion there and what you were doing.
Yep. So in 2011, I was just YouTubing. I watch a lot of YouTube, bit random things pretty much, and I came across a video of people flying remote control planes, what's called FPV, first person view. So people put cameras on planes with video transmitter and then they wear goggles and fly the plane as if they're in, like, from the point of view from the plane. So
yep,
I saw that and thought I might be able to do that, like, and the they had like all these telemetry and stuff, so it was like basically like a fighter pilot. You had the head-up display with your airspeed and your altitude, and even had like return to home autopilots and stuff like that. So I saw all this technology that might be able to make it possible for me to fly a plane. So it became a major focus at that time to figure out whether I could somehow control some remote control planes. So yeah, after lots of thinking about it, we sort of came up with an idea to modify a transmitter to put the controls in a lunchbox so they could be extended up, mounted up near my mouth.
Yep.
And so ended up buying a plane and crashing it on the first flight within about 30 seconds.
That's a rite of passage.
It was a bit disheartening. Afterwards, spent hours on simulator on the computer and it seemed so easy.
Yep.
Everything happens way quicker in real life.
Yep. So, you don't have to give us a dollar figure, but are they pretty expensive, these planes?
No. I always say I feel sorry for the guys like 20 years ago where you had to painstakingly build it out of balsa wood and it takes you months and months to build it and costs you huge dollars, and then on first crash it explodes into a pile of splinters, where these are all foam planes from China and pretty cheap.
Yep.
And yeah, I could just glue it back together after the first crash, and I got a sort of a stabilizer sort of autopilot thing on it, and second flight went amazingly well in comparison. And I can remember having a few tears of joy afterwards just for finally being able to do something physical, because before that point, everything I'd done was just all on computers. Like, that's all I could access. And here I was sort of controlling something out in the real world and being able to fly again, even though it's not real flying, but yep. It's as close as I can get. So,
yep.
Yeah, and then ended up, that became a real passion, and I met a few really good friends locally that we used to go flying as often as we could before we lost access to our flying site. So we haven't been able to fly as much recently as we had done. But yeah, so I got the first person view stuff set up. So I had a camera on a few of my planes and could fly around sort of various nice bits of the countryside. And so I'd still like to do that a lot more, especially these days. There's high definition video kits you can get, and it would be a lot more exciting to do it these days than back then when I was doing it.
Yeah. So you say you're flying space, you need a certain amount of airspace, do you, that you know that nobody's going to fly through?
Yep. Oh, you're supposed to stay below 400 feet, but when you've got a camera plane, like, it's very easy to ignore those rules, because like, they're capable of flying like 10 k's away if you want to, but obviously you shouldn't do that. Don't have anyone listening. But yeah, even just flying line of sight, which is what we did most of the time, because that was a lot easier to do. You don't want any trees around and buildings and stuff like that. So we used to actually fly out at what's now the Cove at Don Heads. So it's an awesome place to fly, just really picturesque. But yeah, they've sort of changed the the access there, so we can't really get into the old paddock that we flew at, so that's a bit of a shame, but we're sort of always on the lookout for somewhere new to fly it.
Yeah, excellent. I'm going to ask you a really stupid question, and this will show you how poorly researched I am. Do they make planes for people in your situation, like actual planes? Can people fly with disability, or is there a certain level of disability that they can fly at? Or
There's a guy called Dave Jacker who's Australian, and he's a quadriplegic. He's a bit lower level than me, so he's got more hand movement. But he actually flew solo around Australia a few years ago.
Yep.
So yeah, it's definitely that. There's no specific planes, and we've tried once to try and get me into a light aircraft, and it was just too hard. Like, maybe if you had 3 or 4 really strong guys, you'd be able to sort of wangle it in, but it's just really awkward to do.
Yeah.
Because especially if they're like the high wing aircraft we tried to get me into, sort of, it's got the wheels right there in the way to get a clear run to the cockpit, and then other aircraft are low wing aircraft, which are more difficult again. I did contact Dave Jacker to ask how he managed it, and he's got like a custom scissor lift device that lifts him up, him in his wheelchair, up to the height of the aircraft seat, and then but he's got enough movement to sort of transfer across himself manually, I think. So
yeah,
that's not really an option for me. So
yeah,
it's probably like, I've seen people go skydiving and stuff like that as quads, so maybe something like that will be possible
in
the future. But yeah, I can't see myself flying anytime soon.
Yeah. So you talked about there before, again, with your journey into independent living. So you lived at Coles Beach. You had a specially made unit off the side of your dad's house there. But around that sort of time, the early 2010s, your dad sort of started to talk to you about moving out and living on your own independently. Was that something that scared you, or was it something that motivated you, that you wanted to do deep down yourself?
I was definitely worried about it. Yeah, I wasn't sure how it would work. And it always sort of seemed to be a few years away, so I never had to worry about it too much until it sort of became more pressing. I have been living by myself now for 3 years. Like I say, by myself, it's with a lot of support from mum and dad and from carers, and friends. But it has worked really well. Like, my main concerns were always over night time, because when I'm in bed overnight, I'm fairly helpless, because the alternative to that, living by myself, would be to ask the NDIS to fund a carer to be here overnight.
Yep.
Every night,
do sleepovers.
Yeah, and that's like a very expensive proposition. I always felt like that would be very poor value for money when it's only once or twice a month where I actually need help. It was daunting, but I definitely wanted to see if I could make it work, and I was very motivated to try and make it work. So
yeah,
I still wonder for the long term whether it's the best thing for me. Like, I would definitely be safer in a sort of more shared accommodation, but I think it's sort of a calculated risk. I've got 2 or 3 different ways that I can contact the outside world if I get in trouble, so I feel I've made it as safe as I can. So far so good. I sort of funded it in a very non-traditional way, because my sister, I had lent her money when she was a poor uni student, and now she's a not so poor doctor. She was able to help fund the rest of it before.
Yep.
So they got the house finished through that, and then I could take out a proper mortgage and pay the loans back. So I was very thankful that it was a much cheaper proposition back then. I don't know if I would have been able to afford it these days with how expensive housing's gone. Mm-hmm. So
it's tricky.
Yeah,
absolutely. And explain to us how it felt then, the day you moved into your house.
Yeah, that was a really good day. Stressful. That's one of the life's biggest stresses, I think, moving house. So maybe the next day I was a bit less stressed and was able to enjoy it more.
It doesn't get any easier if you move, mate, let me tell you. So have a good think about that.
Yeah. It was great to have my own place and not to know that I had that housing security, especially like we know that home ownership is such a massive thing for people's financial security, especially as they get older. So like, it's my own place and no one can kick me out, and don't have a landlord telling me I can't put holes in the wall here or there. And it was very much a great feeling, and had a big sense of accomplishment to have being able to get that far.
Yep, excellent.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for all the help I had along the way to get there.
Yep, no, everyone can use a little bit of help, can't they?
Yep.
Absolutely. So another big part of your story is you met Marnie. So tell us about Marnie and how that came about.
Yep.
And she'll be listening, so make sure you give her a good shout out, mate.
Hi, Marnie. Love you.
Good start.
Yeah. So I'd been, like, I had a girlfriend at the time, my accident, Dana. She did heaps of fundraising for me and stuff like that, but we sort of drifted apart sort of maybe a year or 18 months after my accident. So I'd pretty much been by myself since then. I didn't already really see myself as dateable, or obviously I had very low self-esteem and thought that my disability would be too much for anyone, and didn't really have any, didn't get any romantic interest pretty much over that time. And it's pretty hard to meet people when you're either out with your parents or with carers all the time, so... but yeah, a few people had told me to try online dating, and so I did last year, and met Marnie online, and she lives out at the Trobe, so we sort of see each other as often as we can. And it's been about 8 months now, and that's been awesome. We sort of go and do as much as we can together, and get on really well.
Yep. If I can just take you back to when you did have your accident and you said that you had a partner, what were your thoughts about being in a relationship at that time? Did you feel like it was going to, like, last, or did you sort of think, you know, this person's probably going to step away at some point, or?
Yeah, I pretty much assumed it was inevitable that it wouldn't last, because she was in as a pilot in the Air Force.
Yep.
As well, so I definitely didn't want her to have to give up on that dream, because I knew what it was like to have it as a dream. She was amazing and really supportive, and I wasn't surprised when it didn't last, I guess.
Yeah. Did you actually think that you'd find love again yourself, or did you resign yourself to the fact that it may be just one-man show for the rest of your life, or...?
I probably hadn't given up for the rest of my life, but it's certainly something I hadn't been actively looking for a long time. So I'd probably given up in the short term. I'm very glad I did give it a go.
Yep, excellent. And what's the best part of being in a relationship? What differences have you noticed?
I certainly feel less lonely. And, like, I have felt lonely for a long time, even though I am surrounded by people. Like, I have carers here all the time and see my parents quite often and stuff like that. So, but yeah, it's definitely a different aspect of life that you're missing out on. So just to have that relationship with someone really close and have that intimacy, you sort of realize what you been missing out on sort of when you have that. So.
Yeah. And isn't it funny, though? It's you know, completely true. So many people would echo what you've just said, that even though you can be surrounded by people that love you, sometimes you feel like they have to love you, whereas when you find somebody that chooses to love you, if that makes sense, I think that's such a big important part. And not everyone longs for that, but I think a lot of people, as human beings, they still long for that companionship, don't they?
Yeah.
What have you learned about yourself through your journey, mate?
I feel like I could have done more since my accident. Whenever I say that, people are really kind and sort of say they're proud of me, and a lot of people tell me I'm an inspiration, where I sort of don't understand that at all. I really don't feel inspiring, but it is very nice to hear. And I guess because I do sort of approach life fairly positively, and I do, like, I smile a lot and love sort of meeting people and talking to people, and so I guess I'm pretty happy that I'm a happy person these days, and that I have been able to sort of deal with pretty significant setback sort of mostly positively, especially these days. I feel like I've got a bit more purpose in life, and sort of very happy how things have gone. Like, I still think of myself as pre-accident as the real me. Like people sort of ask, do you accept your situation? And I sort of, it's like I don't really accept it. I would still much prefer to be not disabled. And even something like some of my carers say they don't even think of me as disabled, which I find nice of them to say because I know what they're meaning it in a nice way, but I sort of find it ridiculous because there are just so many things that I can't do that I wish I could do. I certainly get reminded of how disabled I am every day. But yeah, I know it comes from a nice place, so it's good to hear.
Yep. And it's interesting that point that you made there before about accepting. Do you feel that it is important for anyone that's had a major setback to make peace with it in some way, to move forward?
I guess so. You sort of got, you certainly, if you're dwelling on it every day, then that can't be healthy. And it's interesting that like some people, especially people with spinal cord injury, some people are obsessed with the cure and whether the cure is coming in. Some people travel all over the world for what I think are completely unscientific money-making scam sort of things for treatments. So I've never been like that obsessed. And it's funny that like my accident was 23 years ago, and back then people were talking about the cure being 5 to 10 years away, and now they still talk about it being 5 to 10 years away. So I certainly think it's probably not healthy to live your life relying on being cured at some point in the future, because it might be 5 years away or it might be 50 years away. Like, I'm sure they'll crack it at some stage, but yeah, it's you've got to live life now and make the best of what you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a pretty good note to leave it on. That was the next question I was going to ask you. What advice would you give to someone who's had a major life-changing setback? Is there anything else that you'd sort of like to tell anyone that's struggling with that sort of thing?
Pretty much just to try and get back out there as soon as possible, like even if it's a bit difficult. Like, as I said, I lost a few years early on that I wish I could have done differently now. So, yeah, and like people are amazing, like just random strangers I always find are very eager to help, and like they're always sort of holding the door open for me. And cars, it can actually be frustrating sometimes that cars will stop in the middle of the road to let me over when I'm not sort of ready to go, or there's other traffic coming the other way and it's not safe to do so. And so yeah, people have been generally really good, and it does restore a bit of your faith in humanity for how nice people are when bad things happen.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that as well, what you've learned about humanity. Has it sort of changed your outlook on people?
Yeah, I still have my moments of cynicism.
Yep.
I can be a bit down on the way the world is at times. But
that's just an old man thing, mate. I grumble all the time about it.
But yeah, it's, and the way people responded when I had my accident was just amazing. Like all the friends that did fundraising for me, like you had Mel Purcell on here last year, and she mentioned that she did a book of poetry and donated the proceeds to my trust fund. And she also did a car wash, I think, from memory, that they donated some money from. And yeah, my girlfriend at the time in Canberra, she fundraised a huge amount for me. And even the Devonport Rugby Club, I'd only played one season terribly in 98 before I went to Canberra, and they did a big fundraiser for me, and that paid for a van for me so I didn't have to rely on the taxis and stuff like that around the place. There was an air show, big air show in Devonport in the early 2000s because I was involved with the Aero Club, and they donated a huge amount of money. So yeah, I was just really, really thankful for all that help that came through, and that was able to buy me assistive technology. Because like back then, anything disability specific was really expensive. These days, we've got all these mainstream consumer electronics that are all voice controlled and stuff like that. So it's just cheap as to be able to automate a house, or comparatively to what it was. So
yeah,
back then, I mean, I could have an accessible computer and sort of do a lot more stuff than what I would have otherwise been able to do. So
yeah,
it's very, very grateful for all of the support from the community.
Awesome. And it certainly pays to be grateful, mate. And like I say, like it's always inspiring to me. And I know that, you know, you're going to say that you're not inspiring, but I'm just going to talk from my end. Like, it's inspiring for me to talk to somebody who has got every right to be down on the world and mumble and grumble about it and say, you know, all the world shit, look what happened to me. But your attitude, you know, is the opposite. And like I said, I know that you don't feel inspiring, but it's certainly, you know, a story that I feel is going to inspire a lot of people. And it's interesting that, as you say, people tell you that you're inspiring and again, you don't feel inspiring. I think the most inspirational people, I saw a quote the other day, actually, that probably encapsulates it. It says that, you know, I love people that just walk through the world, don't realise how wonderful they are, and just make the world a better place. So, you know, I think you're one of those people. Like I say, you certainly, I don't think you're a burden on us, mate. I think we're lucky to have you. And hopefully, you know, anyone that's looking up to the sky, they might be able to see one of these planes flying over, and they'll know that physically you're not actually there, but at least your eyes are going to be up there in the sky. So stick with it, mate. We look forward to seeing you buzzing about.
Thank you. Yeah, just wanted to also say, like, it is important to focus on the positives and don't sweat the small stuff. Like, we are incredibly lucky to live in Australia, especially with the NDIS. Like, the NDIS is hideously expensive, and I'm sure it's not the best implementation it could be, but it has been life-changing for me. And yeah, I'm very thankful to live in such a supportive society.
Awesome, mate. Well, I'm thankful for talking to you. So all the best with it, and yeah, we'll see you out and about.
Thanks very much.
Big thanks to Tom for catching up with us and having a chat about his life. And it was interesting because Tom was saying that he was quite humbled that I'd even think of his story. And as it came out through our chat, he is quite a humble man. He doesn't feel like he's inspirational to people. But again, I'll reiterate, as I said to him, that I feel sometimes the most inspirational people are people that don't even realise that they're inspirational. They're just going around making the world a better place for others, and he's certainly one of those people. After our chat, Tom also said he felt bad that he didn't mention his fantastic carers, so we wanted to give them a massive shout out. They do a fantastic job, not only Tom's carers, but all carers in the community. Yeah, fantastic people, completely selfless, and yeah, out there taking care of others, so we'd be lost without them. I hope you took plenty from that chat, and probably more importantly, when you're having a bad day, as Tom would say, there's always someone out there that's worse off than you. So, you know, make the most of what you got and get the best you can out of each day. For anyone out there having their own struggles who wants to have a chat to someone, you can call Lifeline on 131114. Men's Line Australia on 1300 78 9978, or you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 224636.